This is Power Athlete Radio. With your host, Denny Kaye, Professor Booty, and the Luke Summers. And now, toes forward, hips locked, shoulders set, and retract those scapulas. It's time for some knowledge bombs.
Everyone, thanks for tuning in to Power Athlete Radio. Well, ladies and gentlemen, despite last week's accusation from our British temp Chauncey, I did not lose my voice yelling at my cats. In fact, I don't even own cats. And if I did, I think I would have enough consideration not to raise my voice at the loving roommates that may one day inherit my small fortune of snow globes. On to more important news, Dr. Parsley is back. This time he speaks specifically to the sleep cocktail, official name patent pending, that John and company have been raving about. As Doc discusses, there really is no substitution for a solid 8 hours of sleep. However, he'll describe some meditative practices that may help with sleeplessness. Why do executives and politicians perpetuate the myth that sleeping less equates to more productivity? Doc debunks the bullshit with science today. Curious as to how certain diets or macro breakdowns may be affecting your Z's? Or what impact sleep deprivation may have on brain function? Stay tuned. Those answers and so much more are just moments away. Remain vertical for the next hour because this is episode 138.
What's happening, Power Athlete Nation? Welcome to Power Athlete Radio, the first show of 2016. I'm ready to rock and roll. I'm joined with John, Luke, and Tex. And our guest today, rocking out round two on Power Athlete Radio, Dr. Kirk Parsley. What's happening, guys?
We're good. Thank you.
Hey, man,
for having us.
Well, happy to be here. I didn't realize that was the first show of the year. I feel
the first show
now.
Of the year.
I like to start off slow and then pick up steam.
I was going to say, it's a good idea to set the bar low and then trip over it from there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been our whole deal. How long have we been doing this podcast? Like 7 years?
No, this is first year.
Oh, okay. First year. Seven.
We're doing a reset. The amnesia reset.
Oh, I like it.
Forget about all the garbage from the previous 3 years, and we're starting fresh.
We found out we were wrong about everything, and...
You know,
everything's changed.
The new year,
it's
new
actually
contest.
Pretty accurate. I should have written my book years ago because I thought I actually knew a lot more then. Now every year I go home and I realize how much little I know, and instantly it gets farther and farther away when I realize I'm like, fuck, this was way easier a couple years ago when I knew everything.
Yeah, exactly. It's like being a teenager, man. It's like the teenagers know everything about life, and then... I felt the same way in medicine and sleep and nutrition and fitness and everything. It's like you learn a little bit and you're like, shit, I know everything. And then you keep pulling back the layers of the onion. And you're like, I'm an idiot. I should just
know. Well, you pull back, that's good also because you're an ogre. So, an ogre's up lots of layers. But, Doc, hey, before you get rocking, can you just give the audience your CV and we can talk a little bit from there about the sleep cocktail and our own experiences. But just remind people how wonderful you are and what a magical, special snowflake you are.
Yeah, I'm a great guy. I'm a great square dancer. Former Navy SEAL, left the SEAL teams, went to college, went to medical school, went under the military's medical school training there, went back to the SEAL teams, helped build the first sports medicine facility they had there, hired a bunch of really smart sports medicine and strength and conditioning coaches and all these guys who knew more than I did. So then I was the dumbest guy around, so they put me in charge of it. So I managed that for about 3.5 years, and all these SEALs started coming to me, talking to me about, this litany of problems that all sounded very similar and all sounded sort of like, metabolic disease or pre-metabolic disease or pre-diabetes. And they had some sleep issues, they had hormonal issues, they had, motivation and concentration issues, and just kind of this whole mishmash of crap. And I realized that medical school had not prepared me at all to deal with any of this, and so I just started really digging deep down the functional medicine kind of pathways and self-education and working with, you know, world-renowned experts on all of that. And that led to lectures and interviews and, you know, whatever, blogging. And the one of the things I did with the sleep, with the SEAL teams, was get them all off of Ambien, because they're handing out Ambien like candy. And in doing so, I had to replace Ambien with something, and that's where the sleep cocktail came from. And it was really developed over the course of a couple of years of just adding ingredient by ingredient and tinkering around with it. And since the launch of that in June, I've been really digging down this, you know, business development track and production and all that. So I spent probably about half my time doing that, and about half my time, you know, being a doctor now.
Well, for those of you guys that don't know, Doc Parsley launched a sleep cocktail that's a powder that you end up putting in about 8 to 10 ounces of water and drink before bedtime. I've actually been using it daily or nightly, more accurately, for, it'd have to be 4 to 6 months. And, you know, we picked up some samples, and I know Luke and the guys have been doing it, and also the bigger one, because I figure we're young, healthy, somewhat young, healthy individuals, actually providing it to my dad and some of our older sleep, older clients around us, like Huey, for example. And, my dad has never slept more than 3 or 4 hours a night, and after taking the sleep cocktail, has had some of the best sleep he's ever had. And he tried Ambien and ended up, like, having some pretty interesting stuff where he, like, found himself, like, downstairs in the kitchen and, like, kind of woke up and was like, how'd they get down here? So that Ambien can be pretty dangerous stuff, but it's actually... we'll talk a little bit about, like, the ingredients and how it all goes. We've had some really interesting, effects and, experiences with it, and that have all been very, very positive. And even we can get into a little bit of loading. I know Luke took, one every 30 minutes until you passed out. I mean, it was a little weird, but, and you were at the bar, which was better.
Well, I was just snorting the powder. I thought that's how you're supposed to take it. And then I just assume powder snort, right? That's what I do with my BCAAs, protein.
But, the membrane of the nose is extremely thin, so it's got much better absorption.
Yes, exactly.
That's what I tell with all. That's what I tell all my BPH clients who, you know, complain they have to get up and go pee like 10 times a night, and if they take the supplement, I say, well, you know, just snort it, then it works well. Don't actually do that.
That was all a joke.
Yeah. Well, that's part of having a sense of humor. So, Doc, just looking at the package, I mean, melatonin, magnesium, and just trying to kind of find, like, the perfect remedy or the perfect amounts to try to help this. And on top of it, it actually has a wonderful apple taste.
Apple cinnamon.
Yeah, oh, apple cinnamon, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank God it doesn't have a Jägermeister taste.
The black licorice taste. Yeah, maybe the next version. I mean, I definitely want to – I mean, there's definitely some stuff I would like to add into that product, but, you know, it'll just have to come as the, you know, business development allows it. But, you know, that product is really just the – you know, the most basic standard form that I came up with working with the SEALs. And, you know, really all I did is I started with, like, basic physiology books on sleep, because literally they don't teach you anything about sleep in medical school, and I hadn't learned anything about sleep in undergraduate. So I just was going back to some just really basic books, and then just working with more and more advanced books, and then, you know, consulting with experts and so forth. But really, I mean, there's two you know, you always hear people talking about sleep hygiene and, you know, doing their nighttime sleep ritual and all that. And that can be, I mean, that's an endless number of things that you could describe as sleep hygiene, what contributes to that. But when your brain is going to sleep, you know, which is basically what has to happen, it's your brain that falls asleep, not really your body, right? There's two things going on. One is that melatonin is being secreted, and that's leading to a lot of effects, which we could talk about as geeky as you guys wanted to. And then the other thing that's going on is that your neocortex, your big human brain that makes us the smartest animal on the planet, that's actually slowing down. So that has to slow down, and that's what that neocortex is how you interact with your environment, right? It's how you sense the environment, and it's how you interact with the environment. And so that part of your brain has to slow down, which is why you can, you know, be dead tired all day at work and say, like, I'm like you're thinking all day, like as soon as work's over, I'm going home and going to bed. And then, you know, one of your buddies, you know, talks you into going to happy hour. You have a couple of, you know, CNS depressants, you know, you have a couple of alcoholic drinks. You should be more tired, but you're more awake. And that's because you've woken up your neocortex. So slowing down the neocortex happens from GABA infusion in the brain and GABA release in the brain. And then the production of melatonin is kind of what leads to the cascade of events that allows the wake-promoting neurotransmitters, things like epinephrine and serotonin and histamine that make you really awake, allows those to be decreased and GABA to be increased. And so all that's in the product is all the constituents along the way of making melatonin, a dusting of melatonin, and then a form of GABA that can cross the blood-brain barrier. So it's nothing super revolutionary. It's just kind of a complete product. You know, it kind of handling both aspects.
Doc, what kind of factors? I mean, obviously, children and babies. I mean, anybody that on this podcast or listening that has kids. The analogy of being able to sleep like a baby is, pretty accurate. I mean, kids just get knocked out. Why is it over time, and as we start to age, does sleep become, like the quality of sleep kind of, deteriorates, and all of a sudden your ability to sleep isn't as easy? I mean, I put my kids in their car seats, and they are sound asleep before I even pull out of the driveway. So, whereas, the older clients and some of the people that I've worked with that were at more advanced age, I mean, have terrible sleep. Is it a hormonal thing? Is it a deterioration of the brain? I mean, what are the key factors that would really drive that?
And it's kind of got to be a crossroads, right? Because there are also people who age and insist they still have no problem sleeping. Sleep like a baby, can fall asleep like that.
Who?
Case in point, the starfish.
Who? You're...
Packy.
Well, she's not even 30.
She's 29.
Okay.
But still at 29.
I think John was more like 60-year-olds.
Yeah.
Okay, like, but like, even going down that, it's a progression. Is it not? Like, I can't fall asleep like a baby.
I still do. If you put me in a car seat, I will fall asleep.
So there's two individuals.
Well, okay, but age. I mean, my dad never had problems sleeping, and then he said it was all around maybe around 40, 45 years old. He was like, had trouble falling asleep. I mean, he's never slept more than maybe 3-4 hours in a night, but he said he used to be able to fall asleep, instantly wake up and be totally rested. And now he has more and more trouble falling asleep. So
compare and contrast my old man, who still is that person, falls asleep at the same time every day, sleeps 8 hours a night, no problem. Bing, bang, boom. Ready to
really?
Go. Yeah.
Okay. Well, get into it, Doc.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things going on there. And there's a couple of variance is how that manifests itself. Really what's going on with children have obviously a really high metabolic rate, and their brain is no different. So their neurological tissue is just a lot more active than us, and they're building up a lot more byproducts. A lot of things like interleukin 6 and TNF-alpha and these sort of some people call them neurotoxins. I wouldn't call them quite toxins, but they're inflammatory components that need to be flushed out of the brain. So that's one thing that's happening to them. But they're also just a lot more active than we are, and they're building up a lot of adenosine from the breakdown of ATP. And adenosine is what causes sleep pressure. So what I mean by sleep pressure is when you that drive to like push you to sleep, to like really crash hard instantaneously, that's sleep pressure. If you're just sort of laying in bed and softly drifting off to sleep over 30 minutes, you have low sleep pressure. If you're somebody who as soon as you put your head down you're snoring, that's high sleep pressure, and it really drives you really quickly into deep sleep or slow wave sleep cycles, which is stages 3 and 4. There's multiple factors that go on. One thing is that, honestly, just most people in their 40s and 50s and 60s aren't nearly as active as they were when they were younger. So there you have decreased, you have some decreased adenosine and a decreased sleep pressure there. Another thing is, people really start having, concerns and worries about their life and, financial future and their kids' college fund and all that stuff, all that kind of starts creeping up, and then that component of sleep that I was talking about where you have to turn the neocortex off and you have to get that neocortex to slow down and quit interacting with your environment. And that includes just thinking about your environment. So that you know, that gets harder, and that's essentially, you know, just stress. You could just simplify that and say that, you know, that there's stress, there's more stress involved. You know, to go along with the stress, you have to consider that people, as they live in a high stress environment for multiple years, you're running into either excessive adrenal function, if you're lucky, or, you know, a complete sort of adrenal exhaustion, which now your entire hormonal milieu has been shifted, and, you know, neurotransmitters that would ordinarily stimulate your brain, you might be depressing your brain and vice versa, because all sorts of receptors and things change in the brain, and it gets really messy there. But you know, the heightened stress, the adrenal, you know, heightened adrenal hormones that then have to be overcome by more melatonin. And then ironically, like, one of the things that we do know that happens to people's brains through autopsies, you know, the elderly tend to have really small sort of shriveled up pineal glands, which is where your melatonin is being secreted from. That's not everything, but that's a lot of it. Nutrition, you know, I would tie into there as well, as just because most people become obviously more nutritionally sensitive as you get older, because, you know, they're less active, because their hormones in their entire bodies have shifted down, their gut biome has shifted, like all of that stuff. Kind of as you get older, you have to obviously pay more attention to things like insulin sensitivity.
So back before the show, we were talking a little bit about the cocktail, and for those of you who are like, you know, just give a little detail on it. It's a packet that you rip open, like John said, drop in 8 to 10 ounces of water, take a sip, and then you go kind of through your nighttime ritual of going to bed. And typically, about a half hour later, in my experience, it's about a half hour, and you're lights out essentially, sleep through the night, and you wake up through the day. Now, you were talking about some people having not having that effect or dissimilar effects. What's going on with that? What's some of the other feedback they get, and what are you finding people are doing right or doing wrong?
Well, so you know, there's really strong science about the you know, the circadian rhythm and the alignment essentially of our bodies, our biological clocks, with the rise and fall of the sun. You know, that's done through, as most people know, light, and particularly blue light that comes into your eyes, and it stimulates your brain to be awake. And as blue light goes away because the sun's gone down, that's when the cascade of events should start to occur to produce melatonin and to decrease wake-promoting neurotransmitters and to increase GABA and to start slowing down the neocortex. You know, what a lot of people don't do is decrease that blue light in their eyes. So, you know, one of the things that the sleep product is designed to do is kind of accelerate that pathway, right? If you haven't done really well with your sleep hygiene, at least we're putting in like every constituent along the melatonin production pathway and giving you a little bit of melatonin and giving you a little bit of GABA, and we're giving you a fighting chance. Honestly, the product doesn't last long enough to keep people asleep if their brain is like completely wired to be awake. So people that are super stressed out, that are maybe in the tired and wired phase, they might have a ton of sleep pressure from, how busy their day is, and they've built up a ton of neurotoxins during the day. They have a ton of adenosine built up in there, so they go to sleep really easily. But you know, they wake up routinely in the middle of the night, so they go, well, I'm going to start taking the sleep cocktail. Well, what's happening with these people is, as soon as their sleep pressure has been relieved by, you know, the flushing of some neurotoxins and, you know, slowing down the neocortex a little bit and hitting a good, you know, nice deep cycle of, you know, at least one sleep cycle, which is about 120 minutes, sometimes two, their excessive adrenal hormones wake them right back up. So what I tell those people to do, you know, I usually have a conversation with them first, and we kind of, you know, figure this out. And if it seems like that's the mechanism that we're fighting, you know, they say, well, I take the sleep cocktail, but I still wake up. I just say, well, you know, mix the sleep cocktail, put it next to your bed, and don't take it until you wake up. If you don't have any problems falling asleep, but you have problems staying asleep, then we can, you know, help you reinitiate the cascade there. But that takes some compliance on the patient's part, or, you know, customer's part, I guess I should say. Because you know one of the worst things that you can do is the most common thing that people do is when they wake up they look at their clock. So you're putting a minimal amount of bright light in your eyes, and so maybe that matters or maybe it doesn't matter. But what you are doing is you're waking your brain up, right? You're looking at what time it is, and you're going to start doing calculations. You're going to start doing some mental math about your day and how you could reorganize stuff. And if you know if you go back to sleep now, you'll get an extra you'll get 1 hour 1 hour and 26 minutes of sleep, or people just start spinning off in all sorts of directions. So I've had quite a people quite a few people talk to me about that. Now we have the I'd say in the last it's only been in the last 3 weeks or maybe 4 weeks I've had a couple of people call and tell me they had this refractory effect to a paradoxical effect from the product. So this is exceedingly rare. I don't know how many thousands, we've sold, 6,000 or 7,000 boxes of the stuff at this point. And so, three people have contacted me and said, this just like makes me wake up. It makes me sleep worse. So in those situations, sometimes that's a shift work issue. But what my research on, these particular guys, led me, led to my understanding of this this process in the brain that I didn't realize happened. So when you're really young and your brain is developing, GABA, the neurotransmitter that's usually slowing down your neocortex, can actually excite regions of the brain. Why that happens in children, we don't know. But it's a different it's a different reaction to the same molecule binding the same receptor. So there's certain regions of your brain where you have a lot of GABA receptors, and when you put GABA in there, it activates your brain. Certain regions of your brain are more active when you go to sleep. But usually the stimulating effect on the receptors throughout the brain and children goes away as you get older. And what I think is happening in these guys, although this is purely a postulate at this point, I haven't seen any research for anybody who's done brain biopsies on people and figured it out, but I think that they're not losing their GABA receptor concentration differences in different regions of the brain like most adults. Those people just really can't take the product just because it has a form of GABA in there. They could probably, take the product if I had a version of it without GABA. And that's what I've been having them do. I just say, let's send you out piecemeal and just buy all the individual ingredients and take it that way and see if that works. And that has worked. So
now this could be, you're clearly the expert, but just anecdotally, I'm always curious if more is better. So I took the product for about 3 days, one packet, then 3 days, two packets. And then I tried three packets before bed. And what I noticed is I had that similar effect that it didn't actually, I didn't slow down. I didn't power down. I ended up just laying in bed like wide awake. And I'm like, well, more isn't necessarily better. I should probably just follow the instructions.
Well, I actually had a little bit of a different deal in that I took one and I felt pretty good. And then I took the second one and I woke up like wiping the side of my mouth because I was drooling all night. And my wife was like,
you went deeper.
Well, she actually said to me, she's like, I was kind of a little nervous for a second because your breathing was so faint that I actually, because my wife is like, typical mom. Like I joke that like ants are talking in the other room and she like wakes up where like the kids like make a noise and my wife's like, what's that? I'm like, oh God. But she goes, you didn't even move to the point where I had to check to see if you were breathing. And I was like, well, maybe too much. But the thing which is kind of interesting, at least with the sleep cocktail, I think it can maybe exasperate problems or bring things more to light. Like, maybe for me, like I've never had problems sleeping. I just take it because I want to test it and use it. And, hey, why wouldn't I want better sleep? But maybe for you, it's overloading. Or, who knows? I mean, maybe it was that coffee you had last Tuesday.
It could be.
Yeah. So, I think... what you guys just said, and John, I think you're right on it, was, obviously you're considerably larger than the average Joe, and so the idea that you would need more of a supplement than somebody else is a pretty logical assumption. But what I have found, and for me, is that if I take two, it does wake me up. So I forget who said that at the beginning, if they took three and it woke him up, or woke up in the middle of the night. What I think is happening there is just excessive serotonin production. Serotonin is in the pathway of producing melatonin, and serotonin is a wake-promoting neurotransmitter. The other sort of, pie in the sky, hopeful idea is that you're getting, a deeper quality of sleep to where you're just doing that normal biphasic sleep that, we evolved to do. So, evolutionarily, people that were, at least say maybe 20 degrees of latitude away from the equator, tended to sleep in two sections of the night because of the night was so long. They would do all their deep slow wave sleeps at the beginning of the night, and then they kind of have this middle of the night waking where it's an hour to an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, and then they would go back to sleep for the rest of the night. But the nights were long enough to do that, and they obviously didn't have time clocks and to be punched and commutes and school schedules and all that stuff. So it's probably not beneficial for anyone to do that dual sleep unless they have 12 hours a night to be dealing with, to be sleeping or to be in bed at least. So that's my postulate with the two possibilities there. I've never had any problem sleeping either. I've always said I sleep great, and of course and the SEAL teams, you sort of learn how to sleep in any environment. I don't think there's a SEAL alive that can't fall asleep on a cactus bush and rocks and have a great night's sleep. And I think that's carried on to me, and I've always been able to sleep really well. But when I started taking the product, you should eat your own dog food. I just sleep better. It was funny. Rob Wolf came over to my house. We were doing a symposium. It was right before your gig. It was the SEAL Fit gig with Mark Devine, and irony of all ironies, I was in California in my San Diego house, and I'd just gotten back from Australia, and I hadn't had any sleep product for about a month. And Rob's like, "Hey, I got an extra one." And I'm like, "Nah, I'm okay." I said, "All right, whatever, I'll take it." So I take it, and then the next morning I woke up, I'm like, "Man, I've got to start using this stuff every night again." So, that's my experience with it.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, over the years, I mean, we've gone in pretty deep into trying to figure out, ideally, with circadian rhythms and what things really affect sleep. And I think I talked to you about this, Doc, offline. We were, when I went and visited Dr. Jin from the Newport Brain Research Center, he talked a lot about circadian rhythms and things that disrupt circadian rhythms. The two, biggest ones he talked about was blue light. I mean, obviously, everybody listening to this probably checks their cell phone right before they go to bed. I know I do, and I sit there, and I, try to, even though I dim it, and I'm sure there's some filter on there to filter out blue light, we always end up checking it because how hard is it to turn off? And then the other two were caffeine, and the biggest one was dehydration through either alcohol or not drinking enough water. The biggest factor he found for people with their sleep was actually being dehydrated. And because the idea of the brain swells and you can't get into, REM, and that's why, everybody here that's gone out for a hard night of drinking will attest that they probably had one of the lousiest sleeps. I don't really know anybody that was like,
feel great.
Yeah, I drank all night and slept like a baby. No, you have a terrible sleep, and part of his deal was actually dehydration, brain swelling, and some other key factors. And I actually found this through a couple clients. I had one client who had his prostate removed because of, obviously cancer, and instead of seeding the prostate and doing that, they just removed it. And so he was having pretty bad problems with, bladder control. And so he was real leery about drinking any water before bed. He didn't want, typical problems that guys deal with later in life, and ended up figuring out that like part of his thing was he was so nervous about drinking water that he was dehydrated, and it was really affecting his sleep. And so it was kind of this catch 22, like you have to stay hydrated, but how do you kind of get there? So sleep cocktail has been extremely beneficial for him. But things like sleeping within your circadian rhythms, which was always pretty interesting to me when you start looking at the most valuable sleep being between that 10 and 2. And I know Dr. Jin talked about that being really the most valuable sleep. And even though you go to bed, let's say 11 or a noon or 11 to midnight or 1 o'clock, really that valuable time is between that 10 and 2. And so from that point on, I always just try to be in bed at least by 9:30, 9:45. And actually last night I went to bed right after the kids at 8:15. And ended up waking up and having some of my best sleep. So I think sometimes, and I know this especially happens to my wife, is that almost like the pressure of not sleeping. So like when you go to bed late, there's this feeling that you have just a finite amount of time. So therefore, you have to get to sleep, which almost puts more pressure on you, and then you can't sleep. So I know just trying to get into the bed earlier and like almost give myself like, hey, I'm going to get into bed earlier. So if it takes me a little bit of time, I don't have pressure, and I can kind of not rush in terms of trying to get to work within 5 minutes kind of mentality. So,
yeah. And then the other thing that happens is you kind of get past that sweet spot of slowing down the neocortex. There was a paper that just came out in Cell Biology last month or a couple of months ago about, they studied some hunter gatherers, various parts of the world, some people that still live like hunter gatherers and don't have any electricity, and they basically eat, a paleo diet, and live as we expect our ancestors lived. Lo and behold, big shocker, they tended to fall asleep about 3 to 3, I think it ended up being 3.3 hours after the sun went down, and they tended to wake up right around sun up. No big shocker to me. The media sort of spun it as to all the, they did actigraphy on it, and the media sort of spun it to where, these guys were only sleeping 5 hours a night because, they were active and, whatever. The actigraphy was saying they were awake, but they felt like they were asleep. But the point of it is what you just said. What they found is that if these guys did tend to stay up later, if they stayed up later for any reason, even though they didn't have problems getting to sleep, if they went to bed at 11 or midnight as opposed to 9 or 10, they still woke up at the same time the next morning. So there's definitely a lot to the circadian rhythm, and a lot more than we even know. We know little bits and pieces of it, but the thing to remember about when we talk about circadian rhythm, we're by and large talking about the lizard brain responding to sunlight. But you have to keep in mind that every single cell in your body has its own biological clock, right? And that's not all completely controlled by the brain. And even your gut biome, those bacteria, they all have a biological clock, and they don't have any sensory input to tell them what time it is. So that's why, people who do shift work are just never going to get, they're never going to get 100% of what they would get if they slept with their, with the way they evolved, go figure. I mean, it shouldn't be shocking, but it is to people that...
Doc, it kind of goes back to that one I had it on my, 42 or 43 things I learned, where my grandmother told me years ago to, learn to sleep and live like a farmer, don't live like and sleep like a bartender. And it's one of those things where, you always hear these like little anecdotes, and I remember I posted that on my blog, and the amount of butthurt from people reading it who were so insulted that one, they were bartenders or they were shift workers, and like, how dare I say this, which is pretty interesting seeing as that it's my blog and something my grandmother told me that I'm relating back
bartender
to them.
Bartender lives matter, John.
And you know what, and how dare I condemn somebody who's doing humanitarian work of slinging fucking drinks at a bar to a bunch of fucking assholes.
You're an elitist fucking asshole.
Or the person that has shift work. And like, my thing is, yes, shift work needs to be done and people that have it. But at the end of the day, your sleep and your life will never be as rich as somebody that doesn't have sleep work. And that was a huge amount of butt hurt, and it was actually pretty epic if you actually go back and read.
Yeah, the comments are just like,
the comments are the best. And I'm like, first of all, go fuck yourself. And two, it's my book or it's my blog, and this is something my grandmother told me. So I'm really sorry that your feelings are hurt, but you know, why blow the fuck up? But it was definitely
There's
pretty accurate.
There's a picture
accurate.
Of a unicorn to make you feel better.
Yeah, no, I mean, but it's pretty accurate. I mean, my mom's family was, you know, I mean, obviously my dad's family as well. But, you know, they moved here, you know, as immigrants from, you know, Denmark. And then my grandparents, other grandparents came from Ireland. And, you know, living on that kind of that, you know, on the ranch, on the farm, you know, years ago, you know, artificial light wasn't all that existent. So all of a sudden at night, you know, as things start to calm down, the sun goes down. And then sure enough, the rooster crows and what I call God's flashlight comes up, which is the sun. And anybody, you know, here that actually sleeps with their shades up, which like we do at my house, you know, and like, you know, seeing the sun come up. I mean, as soon as that sun hits my face, I wake up. And now this time where all of a sudden now it's dark when we get up, we actually bought a machine that is a alarm clock. But you set it and it puts, I guess, light. I mean, I don't know what kind of light it is, but whatever, you know, UV rays or whatever, the ultraviolet light from the sun, it shines it. It has this like kind of panel that looks like a little solar panel. And so all of a sudden that thing comes on and it fills the room with light. And instantly we set it for, you know, 5:20 and it comes up and I literally get up immediately. And then it's funny because my wife literally will get up and go in the bathroom and she leaves it on because she knows if she turns it off, I'll go back to sleep. So she just leaves it on and I'll be like, fuck. And then I get up and then we come to the gym and we train at 6. But it's pretty interesting, and especially with the kids. I mean, like, I know that they are literally zonked, and then when we put up the shades, they're like, you know, the sun hits them, it'll take a few minutes to kind of wear them out, and then all of a sudden they'll get up and start milling around, or they'll put the covers over their head. But, I mean, that kind of deal, I mean, you got to think for, you know, the one thing I've really come to appreciate is as time, technology, and science and, you know, our understanding of what's going around us seems to increase, we actually end up getting farther away from, you know, the way that our lives have been for the last, I don't know, eons. You know, if you're, you know, Ben Carson, it's 6,000 years, but I believe that, you know, millions of years, you know, where, you know, people really, you know, got up when the sun went up and they started to kind of chill out. And when the campfire burned out, they went to sleep, or, you know, how it kind of worked. And that's really been our MO for the last, you know, millions of years based on how you view this thing. So, you know, the fact that, you know, within the last, 10 years now, you've added mobile devices where now we're, you know, everybody's, you know, checking their phones, sleeping with their phones by their bed. And I mean, I just would love to be able to fast forward 40 years and realize, like, you know, these are the problems that we're starting to see associated with them.
Yeah. And I mean, you're so right. The shift workers really get butt hurt about that stuff. You know, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs now and like Fortune 500 CEOs, high-level executives and stuff. And, I mean, you would think that I'm telling one of these guys that they need to murder their children or sacrifice their children to be healthy when I say, you know, you need to sleep more. I mean, nobody wants to hear it. But just like you said, I mean, you know, we evolved to sleep like this. And, you know, as I said in my TED Talk, you know, evolution, if we could have evolved to sleep less, you know, evolution should have favored that, right? Because it was a, you know, it's a very susceptible, vulnerable state we're in when we're asleep, you know, when we're potential game for other predators. So, I mean, it's amazing to me how how resistant people are to this. But like you say, it's almost as though we've just kind of taken ourselves completely off of the globe. You know, it's like, you know, thanks for the ride, but we've got it from here. We're so smart. We're going to make it, you know, dark when it's light and light when it's dark and hot when it's cold and cold when it's hot. And we're going to, you know, drive everywhere instead of walking and wasting all our energy walking. And you know, we're going to figure out ways to eat shit that has nothing to do with food or the planet even, you know, that's completely chemically invented. And you know, to think that any of that stuff has deleterious effects doesn't take a big stretch of the imagination. But for some reason, people want to treat sleep as though it's optional, and it just doesn't make any sense to me why people are so recalcitrant to that idea. I mean, it's it seems really, really obvious. You know, and I've sometimes made the analogy of, you know, comparing sort of the debate and the popular press right now about how much sleep we actually need, and are there these genetic mutants that only need 3 hours of sleep, like Donald Trump or whoever else is saying they're only sleeping that number of hours? And I used to make this analogy between, you know, say like a vegan or an Atkins diet, or vegan or paleo, you know, something really heavy on animal products. But that's not actually the issue. The more I thought about it, even the vegans and the paleo people are both kind of saying, they're arguing about where you get your calories from, not whether or not you need calories. And people are trying to argue whether or not you need sleep. And it would be just as stupid as, you know, starting your own sort of little diet trend, you know, nutritional trend of saying you only need half the calories that you've been living off of since this animal evolved.
Well, Doc, there are people that actually believe, I remember there was a whole dude about basically cutting your calories. If you can learn to live under 1,000 calories, you can extend your life. And I was like, yeah, but you might live like a couple years longer, but you're going to be really fucking hungry and upset about it. But don't you think this really goes back to really like the idea of co-signing? And we run into this almost every single day, where people have these cockamamie fucking ideas about either training, performance, sleep, whatever. And what they're looking for is somebody to co-sign and almost give them the nod and be like, yeah, I think that makes sense. Which actually is justification to get them. And we run into all the time, like, hey, I'm going to do this, this, and this while doing this, this, and this. What do you think? And I think it's a terrible idea. And then they get defensive. And I was like, well, you asked my opinion, and I disagree with it based on all these other key factors. So why don't we take a step back and see where it's flawed? And I realized that people aren't really interested in your opinion. They're more interested in your co-signing or your signing off on their fucking bullshit. And
absolutely, that
to me has become almost like this idea that, you know, there's so much information available to me that I'm going to be able to pull from all these different sources. I'm going to be able to secret squirrel and design my own stuff. And then what I need to do is somebody who has some form of clout bigger than me, I need them to sign off on it. So then when I fuck myself up, I can say, hey, wait a minute, I thought you said this would work. And, something that is, is kind of confusing a little bit to me. I mean, I have a very, very big, vast community of friends and people that I consider to be, you know, the smartest people on the planet, where if I have an idea, I usually ask them, not for them to co-sign, but because I'm interested in their observation or their opinion on it, which will help me kind of decide, like, hey, I'm going to try to drop my calories down to 400 calories, and if I called Rob, and Rob would be like, really, why?
You're an idiot.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and you know what? Like, this goes back to this whole idea that Luke Summers, who occasionally gleans out some serious solid gold nuggets.
Can't wait for it.
But it was actually the idea of the life bouncer.
Oh.
So we have this idea that there are certain things, and it actually started with Caitlyn Jenner, where people go so far off the reservation that they're like at a bar, like you're out, you're having a bunch of drinks, you start lighting it up and acting crazy, and the bouncer taps you on the shoulder and is like, it's time for you to leave the bar. There's a lot of people, and I think they need a life bouncer. The idea that Caitlyn Jenner decided to, you know, become transgender, and then we voted her Women of the Year, to me is odd, because, you know, it's not she went and changed.
That's very diplomatic.
Well, think about this. I mean, what's his chromosome? What's his chromosome?
He's XY, right?
Yeah, he's an XY. Did he change his chromosome?
Yeah.
How do you do that? No. You can't. So technically, even though you become transgender, you're still a man that just removed his male parts and is taking female hormones. You didn't change your chromosome. So it fucking boggles me that, you know, that people want to, you know, and whether or not he wants to live his life as a woman, but the fact that everybody was so up in arms and so happy to congratulate. And I'm like, dude, this... And
well, let's back out of this and say that there are certain situations where you're like, this guy's fucking ruining for everybody.
Yeah.
Like, this is madness. Get him out of here.
So well, that's, I mean, that's
really,
basically
really,
where we're at.
Really... Really what you're describing is, you know, is my experience, in this health sphere, is that, you know, if you want to be really popular, if you want to sell a lot of books and you want to, you know, have a really popular blog and really popular podcast, just go tell people what they want to hear. you know, if you start telling people what they don't want to hear, they tend to tune out, and people don't want to hear that. So just like you're saying, they're looking for co-signers. You know, it's like, yeah, I want a 1,000-pound squat and to break the world's record on in marathons, or you know, something completely stupid like that. They're looking for the same thing when they come to see me. They're like, hey, I want to be smarter cognitively with it. I want to be able to recover faster. I want my sex drive back and my mood and all this stuff. But I don't have time to sleep, so I just want to do it without sleep. So maybe, you know, I've read on this one website that if I, I freaking snort sugar and put butter in my coffee and wear green socks and do fingertip push-ups or something, that'll rebalance everything. You're just any kind of ludicrous crap that people actually want to hear, you're gonna get a lot more media attention and coverage than somebody who's beating the same drum. It's like, hey, no, this is how we evolved. This is how the body works. We've known this shit for a really, really, really long time. Nothing's changed. We'll keep you updated, you know?
Well, I mean, but isn't that really the idea behind like a lot of modern, you know, I mean, I don't use the term modern medicine more in terms of modern pharmacology, where you have these problems. And
isn't there just a pill I can take?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much what we've gone to, is that it's harder to make a life change. It's harder to say, hey, you know what I want you to do? I want you to, when dinner comes, I want you to cut it in half. I want you to put half in a box. And I want to eat that half. And, you know, before you go to bed, I want you to go outside and walk your dog for 30 minutes. I want you to get up in the morning. I want you to try to sleep more. I mean, these are all lifestyle changes. And we've seen this, because not only do we prescribe programming, but we got into the heavyweight fight business of being able to help people with their nutrition and provide some protocols and be able to provide a little bit of accountability. And it's almost, anybody that's been to the CrossFit Football Seminar where I actually got up and spoke, especially about nutrition, I talk about that, you know, when you start talking about food, it's almost as if it's the religion of this millennia, that, you know, people have such an emotional connection to food and things and how they've done. And I actually took it a step further where I realized that sleep is as fundamental in terms of, like, food. And take a step back with me. But those of you guys that are parents, you look at, like, hey, I want to provide my kid, hopefully you do, like, hey, I want to provide my kid a good diet, and I get talked to me 20 questions about all this all the time. What should I feed my kids? What should they, you know, how does this whole thing? And not a single person has ever asked me about, is there something I should do in terms of a sleep strategy that I should build a set of, standards or, habits within my child about sleeping? And that was something that my wife and I were real, upfront when we had our kids. She's like, you know what, I don't want them to have to go through being bad sleepers. So you know what, and I did a bunch of research, and we actually found these people called sleep coaches. And I thought this was bullshit at first, but these people, come to the house, and they spend, like, literally they're there. And as the kid wakes up, they put them back to sleep, and they kind of do this whole kind of sleep strategy. And it took about a week, but, I mean, honestly, our kids, we put them in bed, 7:30 by about 8 o'clock after they're in there discussing their day for about 30 minutes, which is pretty hilarious to listen to 2 4-year-old twins discuss their day for 30 minutes. If you ever want to have a good laugh, sit outside the door. But then they fall asleep, and they sleep pretty consistent, other than, because they're so little, they have really small bladders, so they, like, have to get up, and then they have to come and tell you that they went to the bathroom, and then they go back, and they're fine. But really building healthy sleep habits, I think, starts at such a young age. And you really think, like, parents don't really understand about it. So what do? They kind of let the kids sleep when they want to sleep, or they sleep here. So, I mean, during the day, if our kids are tired, my wife's like, don't let them sleep. I mean, do they take their nap? They're, this is the nap time, this is the sleep time. And just being really, almost draconian in a lot of ways with it has been, really pretty good. But that idea of, like, you have to be a good sleeper from such an early age to be able to set those, just like food. I mean, if you feed your kids a certain diet and, like, a lot of the stuff that we recommend, they develop a set of taste buds and kind of this is what they eat. And, like, even to the point with our kids now, like any type of conventional candy or stuff, they're like, oh, too sweet, and they push it away. And it's because they've never been really exposed to a lot of this crap. So now all of a sudden here they are at age 4, and they're like, they'll, like, won't finish stuff, or they'll push it away if they're just like, oh, it's too sweet, I can't eat it.
Yeah, but don't your girls like chicken?
Actually, no. Well, I'll tell you, like, so I fucking hate chicken, to the point where, like, I would rather eat dirt than chicken. And so, you know, we, you know, like I go kill things. Like we got a bunch of elk. I mean, you know, we buy some grass-fed steaks. We buy all this killer meat. We crock pot. And so we pretty much have fed the girls red meat at least 1 to 2 meals a day forever since their lives. And my wife was like, you know, let's change it up and get some chicken. You would have thought that this fucking chicken thing was life-changing. They get so excited. Like we had a crock pot chicken, like this chicken soup last night. They fucking crushed it, asked for seconds, and were so happy. My daughter's like, I love chicken. This is my favorite meal. I look at her, and I was like, we ate chicken like 5 nights a week growing up other than hamburgers and rice. So, like, the fact that it just, yeah, I literally shake my head. My wife and I just laugh. We're like, I can't believe these kids like chicken. But maybe it's because, you know.
Yeah, the exact opposite.
Yeah, the exact opposite.
I mean, what you're really alluding to is the problem that we all face in this industry is, you know, trying to talk people into the undeniable reality that lifestyle is going to dictate their life, right? Their health, and you know, there's all these you know, quote unquote biohackers out there now, you know, spinning yarn about all these different things that you can do to hack your, you know, hack this and that feature of your, you know, millions of years old of evolution. And I always remind these people, it's like what you started that whole thing out with was the pharmaceutical industry, right? The pharmaceutical industry, they are the original biohackers, right? They are the original people who said, hey, let's try to make a molecule that kind of looks like that molecule and does a better job than that molecule does. And we'll have people eat it and then they'll sleep better. They'll have better erections, or they won't die of cancer or whatever the kind of trick is. And, you know, how has that turned out so far? I mean, pharma's getting beaten on right now. The only reason it exists is because we have so many people with disease now
they're crushing it. They're making a lot of money. So, in terms of making money, they're crushing it.
But they have a government. You know, like a U.S. government, almost really a world government endorsement of the monopoly on shit.
It's a fucking scam. I mean, the only bigger scam than Big Pharma is anybody that claims to biohack anything. The minute I hear the term biohacker, every hair on my body goes up and I get the spidey sense of bullshit. And I actually want to scream Mortal Kombat and like front kick them in the chest as I pull out my sword and fucking slice them in half.
Call that bullshit.
Dude, I tell you, if I hear one more fucking person talking about hacking their own code or biohackers, the original biohacker and probably the smartest dude in this industry is Tom Inclodon, and he won't even fucking use that term because he hates it so much. So, now that I got that off my chest.
And now that you've murdered somebody with a sword, we can move on to something.
Doc, okay, we could talk about this, but I really want to kind of turn this and steer this a little bit to ketogenic diet, ketosis. You know, you and I have been, you know, obviously on this, you know, the keto train for a while. I mean, and, you know, we're going to preface it with, you know, a ketogenic diet is something that's not only interesting to us, but also beneficial for people like Doc and I that have, you know, had some, you know, obviously mileage before it. And I'll preface it that a ketogenic diet is not what I would call a performance-based diet for anybody that's doing heavy glycogenic or glycolytic type training. But in terms of people that might have some, you know, neurological problems or some other things. So, I mean, we're really kind of, even though people have known about ketogenic diets for 150 years, we're still learning a lot of stuff. I mean, anybody wants to check it out more, we're going to have Dr. Perlmutter on, and we've also had Ken Ford and Mauro De Pasquale and other people. So Doc Parsley is also very knowledgeable on it. So, Doc, let's wrap about that.
Yeah, well, as you say, I've been doing the ketogenic diet myself for a couple of years now, I guess. I was really, really intrigued by it from Peter Attia, who's a good friend of mine and really smart on the ketogenic diet. Obviously, one of the leaders in that field. And you know, for a guy like me, who has, you know, I would say a lot more cognitive and longevity goals than I do performance, any type of physical performance goals. It's a great diet. As you talked about, it's not a very anabolic diet, and that makes sense to me, sort of, you know, intellectually. If you think about, you know, when humans would have been in ketosis, you know, ancestrally, that's during a famine. And so, you know, why would you be, you know, using your body stores to be trying to do anything anabolic? You're just trying to rip out every little fat cell that you can and produce these ketone bodies. The interesting thing how it relates to sleep is some people, when they first, even if they just go to a low glycemic diet and they have some insulin sensitivity issues, it actually, you know, can cause some sleep difficulties in people. And I think one of the reasons, nobody knows the mechanisms for sure on this, but we know that people who have poorly controlled blood glucose, even a pre-diabetic, but definitely a diabetic who's not well managed, they tend to have a lot of sleep problems and they wake up a lot. You know, they wake up 300 times a night. They don't get good quality sleep. They're more likely to be apneic. All sorts of things go on there. So if you have poor insulin sensitivity and then you go low glycemic or you go to the extreme and you go ketotic, well, yeah, no duh. Like you're going to, until your insulin sensitivity comes up, you're probably going to have problems sleeping. But the other really interesting fact is for people who don't know it, your brain primarily uses glucose as its fuel source, and the way that's processed into energy creates some oxidative free radicals, and so you have some oxidation, which builds up some of those neurotoxins that I was talking about that actually kind of make you feel sleepy and make you feel tired and require being flushed out. The way ketones, beta hydroxybutyrate, is used to create energy in the brain doesn't require any oxidation. So presumably you're going to have less of these neurotoxins built up in your brain, and you know there's a potential that at least that aspect of sleep, which I would say is maybe 1/10 of the reason that we need sleep, would be to flush those neurotoxins out. If you don't have as many neurotoxins to flush out, perhaps that's just leading to, a little higher quality of sleep, and maybe you're a normal 8.5 hour person and you'll only need 7 hours. I would think that's plausible. If you go ketotic and you're only sleeping 3 or 4 hours, that's a bad deal, and you need to look into it. And as we were talking about earlier, that can indicate some pituitary stalk issues, or even some, unlikely to be a pituitary tumor, but most people, depending on how old you are, as people age, most people tend to start getting some atrophy of the pituitary. A lot of people have some pituitary stalk injuries that they don't recognize, and so they're slightly hormonally dysregulated in one area or another. And then one final thing, the interesting thing about ketosis specifically is that when you drive your insulin levels down really high, or really low, I'm sorry, it's, I think you know, I think we've talked about it, it drives your sex hormone binding globulin up. As that sex hormone binding globulin builds up, that's binding your sex hormones and it's decreasing your free testosterone, which is perhaps one reason that it interferes with anabolic behavior. But we know through the studies that we did at the SEAL teams, it's almost a direct one-to-one correlation. Total, your how much free testosterone you have and how much time you'll sleep. And if you crush somebody's testosterone levels, they don't sleep well. And if somebody sleeps well, their testosterone levels are really high. Like that's just kind of inextricably linked there.
So, Doc, in terms of like a ketogenic diet and ketones in terms of traumatic brain injury, I know that TBI and other neurological problems are really, really prevalent in the SEAL teams, whether it's from breaching or blasting or being around some form of everything that bombs going off, bullets, everything that would kind of affect neurological stuff. And then you start talking about sleep working, shift working, obviously very reckless lifestyles. Anybody that has ever worked with any of the guys in Naval Special Warfare know that, to be good at that job, you have to be somewhat reckless, similar to NFL players. But that kind of idea of, ketogenic diets in terms of being able to reverse or aid or manage some of the TBIs, the CTE. I mean, right now with the concussion movie coming out of the NFL, it's pretty interesting how many hits and how many emails I've been getting about people that are having neurological problems or ex-professional athletes, and you know, their big question is, you know, can a ketogenic diet help me? And you know, just with looking for any information. I mean, you know, we had Ken Ford on, and who, you know, dropped some, you know, great knowledge about it, and you know, his thoughts about, you know, how it could help, and you know, the use of ketone esters and ketone salts.
Yeah. So I mean, I like hit, you know, Ken Ford and Dominic's you know, information are probably the leading edge on that stuff on TBI. Yeah, the threshold for TBI is amazingly low when you look at how dynamic you know, something like special warfare is, or you know, the even the you know, the G-force exerted in professional athletes and in any kind of contact sports. We know it leads to, you know, a ton of hormonal dysregulation, and but we also know that it leads to atrophy of certain brain regions. And what, you know, what animal models so far are at least bearing out is that if you, you know, if you put somebody on a ketone on a ketotic diet, they're having less oxidation, as we talked about earlier, and that and lowering the oxidative rate tends to lower the you know, the decay of neurological tissue. And you know, maybe it's just slowing it down and then allowing remyelinization to happen. And of course, having, you know, a surplus of you know, lipids floating around for that, you know, of cholesterol products floating around to do that remyelinization. You know, that's you know, in my opinion, probably the biggest mechanism of how you know, a ketotic diet helps people with TBI. Now, observationally, we know it helps, right? There's just no doubt about it. Like, you put somebody on a ketotic diet, and, you know, if there's some research that says somebody's done worse, I've never seen it. People always do better cognitively. You know, the problem is for certain types of professions, you know, can you be, you know, glycolytic and explosive enough, and you know, do your job while being ketotic? You know, so that's the difficult balance point there, for I'd say.
Well, I mean, there's some, you know, we went a little bit down the rabbit hole with genetic testing, and we've been working with you know, Dan Reardon and Fitness Genes, you know, try to get some, you know, just some baseline genetic stuff and see if we could help people not only with diet, but also kind of push them into a specific style of training that was both you know, most advantageous for them. One of the ones that was pretty fascinating to me was people's efficiency with dealing with carbohydrate, or really, you know, how much carb they really need. And so there was definitely some genetic makeup for, you know, and, you know, however it all fits, it's not a one-to-one deal. It's actually a combination of genes. But one of the comments on mine was that, you know, my genetic type was extremely efficient with carbohydrate, whereas, you know, Luke, for example, was more inefficient with carbohydrate. And I remember when Dan was here rapping with us, I was like, well, explain this to me. What do you mean efficient? He said, you know, you get a lot out of not as much. So, you know, there's, you know, you don't have to eat as much to get the same effects. Like, you fill glycogen stores a lot easier with less carbohydrate than some people. And I thought, you know, that kind of makes an interesting point that, you know, maybe certain people function better in a lower carbohydrate environment than people. And I know for Luke, when we saw that, well, the first thing we did was we just upped his carb, and actually he ended up, you know, feeling better and doing well. And I know that on a higher carbohydrate diet, I actually end up feeling worse, and body composition really goes away, and just even like performance-wise, I end up just kind of feeling really sluggish, and that's been, you know, kind of anecdotally things that we've found with people where, you know, we've run into people that, you know, even eating, you know, a third, you know, or isocaloric kind of, you know, balanced macro kind of approach, where people be like, you know, this is way more carb than I'm used to, I feel really tired, I feel really sluggish, I don't seem to be doing good, whereas other people soak it up like a sponge. This kind of begs the question that there really isn't one, you know, macronutrient ratio that's specific for each person. And I think the more and more I get into this, I realize that, you know, there's an, you know, to use the Rob Wolf, you know, typical, whenever you hear Rob ever talk about everything, he always talks about tinkering. And I always assume that, yeah, you know, that comes from his chemistry days of just fucking around in the lab tinkering all day with Lalonde. But that idea that there's just no one-size-fits-all approach. The one thing that I've found that's a one-size-fits-all approach is eating real foods. And that kind of perplexes me a little bit more because, you know, right now in the, you know, the nutrition kind of fitness community, there's a big kind of if it fits your macros approach where food quality doesn't mean anything. It's all macronutrient ratio. And you know what? And I think if you're looking at things from in terms of like your only marker for whether or not this diet or the approach that you're eating is whether or not you can see your abs. Technically, I've seen fucking people lean out on beer, potato chips, and beef jerky. But in terms of like health and wellness and being able to live a long, fulfilling life, a diet of potato chips, Cheetos, and fucking cupcakes, regardless of how you balance the macronutrient ratios, while you might be able to see visible abs, is not a diet necessarily a health or one that I want to necessarily look at the blood work and be like, awesome, your blood work looks amazing off of fucking Cheetos and cupcakes. But there's also this idea that that it doesn't matter, and food is food, and this, and I don't know when we kind of went down the road of fucking crazy people. I thought we dispelled the balancing of macronutrients into some secret ratio that'll somehow safeguard me for something when we stomped on Barry Sears years ago with Rob.
Yeah. Well, I think that's exactly where organizations like yours are needed, and the day-to-day health improvement of Americans. Definitely physicians and what we call the medical care system, which should be called it's what it should be called, medical care, not healthcare. Doctors don't deal with health at all. They deal with disease and medicines, and so it should be called disease care, medical care. But guys like you who have the opportunity and a business model that allows a lot more interaction with people and a lot more frequent interactions with people, and you can do really simple stuff and tinker around with people's carbohydrate load. With or without genetic testing, you can see what their insulin sensitivity is. And if their insulin sensitivity starts sucking, then that's too much carbohydrates, regardless of how they feel. That's not going to be better for it. It's not going to be good for them in the long run. Of all hormones, I would say insulin is king. Cortisol would probably be the close second. But, if you don't have those two things right, it's really hard to argue that you're healthy, whether you're ripped and, six-packed up or not. As I told in my brief intro, when these SEALs came and talked to me in my office about all the problems they were having, I did these blood panels, these serum panels that had, either 98 or like 106 different markers that I'd learned from all these different gurus, in this sort of functional medicine field. And I was interpreting all this stuff. And I would have 28-year-old guys come into my office with all of these complaints, they take off their shirt and they look like a freaking anatomy chart. They're just completely shredded and ripped. Their performance would still be good by most people's standards, but it's not what they're used to, performance-wise. And then you look at their blood markers and they look like a fat, pre-diabetic, 60-year-old man, including their sex hormones. And, a lot of that had to do with sleep, but a lot of that had to do with other lifestyle issues as well. And one of those things is like excessive sympathetic tone, from the high stress, high press lifestyle, which is where all the arousal control stuff comes in, to help people balance their autonomics, their parasympathetic and sympathetic. And that's what, heart math and heart rate variability and meditation and all that stuff is meant to do.
Boy, I know in at least my own experience that, the one thing that's always kind of been universal in terms of macronutrient ratios has always been protein. I've never really seen anybody improve body composition by eating over, a gram, maybe a gram and a half, of protein. But I've seen definite changes in body composition when people are eating under, half to three-fourths of a gram of protein. So it's pretty interesting when you look and be like, it doesn't matter what type of camp you're in, whether you're in a low-carb, high-carb, how everybody skins it for the most part, everybody's pretty consistent on protein. And so the comment that that I talked at the seminar and really just kind of expound is this idea of like, let's set up just kind of a balanced macronutrient approach. Based on a certain caloric load, and this is the amount of protein I want to eat, and then we're going to basically tinker with fat and carbohydrate based on you as an individual, like not only genetically, metabolically, age, and performance dealing, and then trying to tinker with them, trying to maximize performance on that. And it really just to me seems like the most logical approach, and the thing which, you know, we've said so many times on this podcast is the approach that makes the most sense and the most logical is usually the least polarizing and the least exciting approach that will have almost the least amount of followers. So, I mean, whenever I meet people that are, you know, really going through with some... Wow, you hear that thunder?
El Nino. Damn.
Dude, that was... I thought Luke was over there flexing his biceps for a second.
No,
yeah, that's his stomach. But the that idea of, like, you know, middle of the road, and it's actually, frankly, what I look for most of the people that I deal with. If somebody is too far off the fucking reservation and almost too polarizing... where I'm like, dude, this is crazy talk. Like, you know, let's take it a step back. Let's, you know, so the light bouncer doesn't come and throw you out. But let's pull it back and, you know, look at it. And I think the thing which is least sexy in this environment, and this really kind of trips me out, is, you know, the approach that the side that you've taken where you're like, hey, I want you to, you know, try to, you know, nurture that parasympathetic, you know, whether meditation. I want to talk about, you know, increasing the sleep cocktail. I mean, things that are non-crazy people opposed from, you know, we'll get, you know, maybe 20,000 views on your TikTok versus the guy that's talking about how to biohack your sleep so you only have to sleep in 30-minute segments three times a night, and then that guy has fucking 400 million views on his TED Talk. So it comes to me that it's almost this idea, and I can't remember who said it, but it's like, if you find everybody agreeing with you and everybody on, you probably need to change your position. So... I know the other thing we wanted to wrap at as we're kind of coming to the end of our time is a little bit about meditation and that parasympathetic and sympathetic system.
Just to want to jump in, is I've heard that meditation plus 6 hours of sleep is equal to 9 hours of sleep. So is meditation that biohack towards, I know people have a problem committing to sleep, but if you get them to commit to the practice of meditation, is that a way to kind of jumpstart some benefits?
No, what I would say is, I don't know exactly what study or what literature that quote's from. It all depends on what you're measuring sleep by, right? So if you know, perhaps somebody did a study and said, you know, if people meditate 6 hours a day, or you know, sleep 6 hours a day, meditate an hour a day, then they have, you know, the same heart rate variability as somebody who sleeps 8 or 9 hours a night, or, you know, something like that. Yeah, that's possible. Maybe you can find a metric or two metrics or three metrics to support something like that. But just like John was saying with the nutrients, I mean, there's way more to you know, building and maintaining your physiology than, you know, how many carbs, proteins and fat, you know, molecules or grams you're eating, you know. So, you know, I don't think that there's any replacement for sleep. And what I would say is if somebody was willing to meditate for an hour and a half a day and sleep for, you know, 6 hours a night, I would say you'd be much better off just sleeping for your 6 hours a night and then sleep that hour and a half that you're going to meditate, just take a 90-minute nap. And then you can actually meditate during the day. I mean, there's no real magic to meditation, and you know, this is probably the most polarizing thing I'll say all day. We know that the balance of the parasympathetics, which is, you know, the heart rate variability, is one of the good ways to one of the easy ways to measure how well you're balanced sympathetically and parasympathetically. We know that if you slow your breathing down to 4 to 6 breaths per minute for 2 minutes, you essentially become autonomically balanced. That's what meditation is doing. When people are focusing on one thing, focusing on their breath is the usual way that starts. There's different forms that that focus on other things. But, you know, what they're really doing is they're focusing on the now. They're being really conscious of what's going on right now, which is the whole key to avoiding stress. I mean, stress, by definition, really is just that you are living in the future, and depression is that you're living in the past. And you have to really live in the now to be sort of balanced. And the autonomics is a really good measure of that. But what we know is that people who are even mildly sleep deprived, like people who sleep as you're saying, 6 hours a night. If we have people sleep 6 hours a night, they become sympathetically dominant. And it's because their brain is fatigued and they need more of, you know, they need more epinephrine and they need more norepinephrine, which are the primary sympathetic neurotransmitters, because they need these things to stimulate their brains awake. That's, you know, that's adrenaline. That's the same thing that your adrenal glands are secreting to keep you awake. And that's why adrenal function increases when you're sleep deprived, because you have to be able to mobilize fuel and energy by some mechanism, because you haven't done all the normal stuff. So I would argue that I don't think that there is a replacement for sleep. You would be better off if that's all you could do is sleep 6 hours, do your 6 hour sleep, find a way to do a 90 minute nap or 3 30 minute naps during the day, and then do some breathing exercises, you know, and just do breathing exercises. You can do that anytime. You can breathe, you can slow your breathing down 4 to 6 breaths a minute for 2 minutes, and you essentially balance out your autonomics. And you could do that 100 times a day without changing anything about what you do, really.
Hey, Doc, what was the study that we discussed about the sleep study? Was it in Sweden where they were putting people in like a dark black room for like 12 hours and they were sleeping, and then all of a sudden they were like, you know, like the... they basically filled their sleep bank and then they all were sleeping about 7 or 8 hours a night?
I thought that was Denny's baseball.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's where he keeps his kids when they make noise during the podcast. All right, Doc, sorry
about that.
So there's lots of versions of that. I don't know what we spoke about specifically the last time. I think the original one was what was called a bunker trial. And I can't remember where that was located, but it would have been somewhere that still had a significant amount of World War II bunkers. And yeah, exactly what you said. They took volunteers. Volunteers tend to be college students because they're the only ones that really have the time or motivated by the small amount of money that a research trial will give. But what they did is they put them in this dark room for 12 hours a day. I take it back. They put them in the dark room for 14 hours a day. And all that was in there was a toilet and a bed. It was a cool room. It was completely dark. There was nothing for them to do, no way for them to stimulate themselves awake. And they found that the average person was sleeping about 12 and a half hours when they first started. And that's because we're all walking around with a sleep debt, just like we're, you know, most Americans are walking around with credit card debt. Most Americans are walking around with a sleep debt. This is the same thing. You deprive yourself of sleep and it has to be caught up on. It has to be paid back. So they were sleeping about 12 and a half hours a day on average at the beginning, and then over the course of 3 to 4 weeks, I think maybe the longest was around 6 weeks, people would just titrate down to where they were sleeping 7.5 hours a day in this completely dark room, which, you know, the flip side of that is really the amazing thing to me, that if you could lay in a completely dark, cool room with no stimulus around and stay awake for 6.5 hours, you know, you don't need any sleep. Like that would be a pretty hard thing for almost anybody I know to do, even me.
I don't know. I mean, it depends on how many days and times you're cranking it, because I'm pretty sure that's what they were in there doing, just cranking it all day.
That's called the crank study.
Yeah. Well, that was a Luke Summers study who, you know, did you stay home from school one day and what, cranked it 39 times and...
No, that was my buddies that legitimately told us 30 plus one day.
Yeah, stayed home from school plus. And just cranked it 30 times.
How did he sleep, though?
And you slept great.
Well, he's so tired, so calorie deprived. He actually lost 40 pounds. So there's a diet. Let's put that diet out, the crank it diet.
Squeeze out the poison, man. It's that poison that's causing all the problems.
All right, on that note, Doc, hey, thanks for coming on. That was amazing. And
thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have a link set up.
Yes. We're going to have a link set up for you guys. If those of you listening, we'll post it up and do a blog post about it on Talk Me Johnny and Power Athlete about the sleep cocktail. And if you guys want to give it a try, we'll post up a link where you can find it. And
some common do's and don'ts. Do use it as advised. Do not put it in your butt like Fisher did.
Yeah. So be a doer. Don't be a Fisher, which would insert it into his skin. He likes to keister it. So, yeah, that's why he's known as Fisher Keister.
But
hey, John, we gave you a discount code too, right?
Oh, we
did. Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, it's a. Yeah. We'll get all the details up in the post, and then in the blog post associated with this show. So head to powerathletehq.com, click on the blog, then radio. You'll find it in there, and or just search Kirk Parsley. Yeah. But anything else, Doc, that you want to share with the audience?
No, you guys are just a shiny, happy group of folks, man. I appreciate being on.
Doc, I'm sad we don't get to see each other more, seeing as you're jet-setting San Diego, Texas, Australia. This guy's like an international world traveler. You know, Doc, we've been trying to get together to do this blood glucose test for like 4 years.
Yeah.
And his follow-through is about as good as mine.
One of us will have to get in our car and drive to the other
dude,
one.
Dude, if you are, I will gladly, I'll get in the car right now if you actually tell me where you are. Every time I talk to you, you're like, I'm here. This guy's just a jet setter, you know? But you tell me when you're in San Diego and I will come down.
I'll give you my next dates and you can come to my house and we'll sit there and do 2-hour OGT TT together.
And then we'll just start taking lots of sleep cocktails.
See what happens.
We're like, hey, we're going to do some blood glucose testing and sleep cocktails. So we're going to get whacked up and then whacked down.
Yeah, I think we were mixing it with 8 to 10 ounces of vodka as well.
Well, it actually worked out well. So I took 3 packets, mixed it in Red Bull, and then added vodka. And then, you know what? That way I was jacked up, downer was the recipe. Yeah. Legit. So thanks, Doc. I really appreciate it.
And by the way, I guess this is going up pretty soon, but probably within the next month but in the next couple of months, we're changing the name. Apparently, that's a terrible name, the Sleep Cocktail, for all sorts of marketing reasons. That's a really bad name, but it'll still be the same product. So,
what will it be called? The Roofie?
The Roofie. I don't know what it's going to be called. I'm letting my marketing team decide that. They're doing all their little millennial keyboard geeking stuff and figuring out what people like, and they're going to come up with a new name, and we're going to throw out some new packaging and all that stuff. So we'll have to send you some new banners and whatever when that happens. But it's going to be the same product. Just have to change the name.
Awesome, Doug. Thank you.
Yeah. Cool. Talk to you guys later.
Thank you.
Bye.
Now it's time for you to empower your performance. Keep your eyes peeled on powerathletehq.com for more details on Dr. Parsley's highly effective sleep cocktail. If you want to view other publications or research from Doc, head over to www.docparsley.com or follow him on Instagram at Kirk Parsley. I know it's a little late, but Happy New Year to everyone. Don't forget, in 2016, do more and suck less. Bye! Little white pill for them little white lines. I'm